good.
Surely good. Once again, we got another member of the Direct-to-Video Digest. We got the one, the only Mike Parkin.
Good evening. Glad to be here, Sam.
Yeah, I love it. You just pulled a Hitchcock. Good evening.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Absolutely. We were pretty much just thinking, hey, what are some obscure kind of just movie, TV show franchises we could discuss, you know, because everyone likes to, every other podcast seems to want to just talk about only recent stuff or stuff that's been talked about, but to accommodate a recent streaming or Blu-ray thing, like, no, let's get into something that's like, it's kind of a thing, but like some of these more less talked about, you know, Brazil or Swedish type franchises, you know, it's just like, this is going to be fun because it's, you know, action, crime, drama, and it's all kind of word of mouth. Obviously, they've had a wonderful, I just did some research before we even got started, Eureka company released them on a Blu-ray 2-pack. You can only get it if you got a region-free player, but even had an interview, apparently, with an Asian film expert as from New York, as well as Simon Broad, who's the voice of Chow Yun Fat for the English. I'm like, see, that's a cool thing in a collector's booklet. This franchise, comes on the heels of John Woo's, you know, A Better Tomorrow series, and much like that, is very heavily inspired by The Godfather and Once Upon a Time in America. And it follows two brothers played by Alex Mann and Andy Lau in very early roles as violent criminals who cross paths with a charismatic gangster portrayed by Chow Yun-fat. Once again, this was around the same time he did City on Fire, which is best known as the undercover heist movie.
Yeah, that Costa Tarantino Robert. Liberally borrowed from.
Yeah, word for word in Reservoir Dogs. In this giant film, essentially, they rise through the ranks in the first film, Rich and Famous, and then in the action-packed secondary film, Tragic Hero, which came out the same year, all three characters have changed, and one of the brothers is now a violent triad leader seeking revenge. That also features Danny Lee, who would reunite with Chow Yun-fat 2 years later for The Killer.
Yep.
I had fun looking up the director, Taylor Wong, who's done a lot of obscure stuff, other stuff with Andy Lau, as well as Leon Lei. His films include The Free Swordsman, No Risk, No Gain, sequel to Casino Raiders, Fantasy Romance, Triads, The Inside Story, and The Truth, which is a Andy Lau legal thriller. And I'm like, see, this is interesting because this guy's not mentioned in the same wavelength as either Wu or Ringo Lam or Johnny Toe, but that's okay. You know, he's still a working filmmaker.
Yeah, it's interesting as well. I mean, his first two films were Buddha's Palm and I think it was called Flying Daggers was the other one.
Yeah, he's in Shaw Brothers era. Who does
Yeah, exactly,
that?
The Shaw Brothers. But it is, you know, both of them are very much, you know, they're sort of around about 82, 83, I think. And, you know, they're very lean heavily into things like lightsabers and stuff like this going on.
Crazy fantasy.
Lots of flying. Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of flying. There's a film that Andy Lau did, I think it was with Leon Lai as well, called Savior of the Soul, which has a similar sort of look and feel to it, which was a lot of fun. But yeah, these, you know, he did these two early ones, and then he did a couple of sort of gritty sort of crime thrillers. I think one was called Pursuit of a Killer, and the other one was, I think it,
he was cool to research because it's kind of like who we got nowadays. You know, if you got a direct-to-video limited release kind of B action guy, you're looking at people like Isaac Florentine or Jesse V. Johnson. If you're looking at a more mainstream person, then you got kind of has-beens like, you know, Scorsese and Walter Hill, as well as newer ones like, you know, who've been around since the 90s, like Antoine Fuqua, Martin Campbell. And so it is cool to just know that, you know, every country also kind of has that. They always got their additional guy who's taking out the trash and being a genre filmmaker instead of the only talked about guy or only Oscar bait kind of stuff.
Yeah. It reminds me actually of Stephen Hopkins, because he seemed to be like a, you know, a very much a director for hire. He doesn't have sort of passion projects of his own as such. But he's a very solid,
so good at what he does do, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, absolutely. He always turns out some great films. But you know, he hasn't got that sort of passion project sort of tucked away. He's very much a studio director. And that's kind of the vibe I'm getting from Taylor Wong, I think.
Totally. We like these guys because they really are good at being genre people. You know, Hopkins is definitely a perfect example of someone who, like Anthony Hickox and Rennie Harlan and some of those other guys, they do a chiller and then they do a thriller and then they do some other kind of blockbuster. And it didn't matter if it wasn't good or not, they'd recover because they were on budget, they had good production quality. And it's interesting, too, how, you know, Richard Fleischer, you know, took over for Richard Donner in Superman 2, but he's the king of doing disaster movies that were in the vein of Irwin Allen. So, I mean, and I think, yes, that is a good point, because there are so many other filmmakers who nowadays you'll see them and it's like, you guys come off as too workmanlike. You don't really seem to have any passion or soul to this. Yeah. You know, why are you here? And
we delve into sort of the bottom end of the market a lot. And you know, I hate to sort of mention anyone, but there's a company called Bondit, basically Bondit Finance Group or something along those sort of lines. And they were responsible for a lot of the Bruce Willis films.
Oh yeah, Emmett Furla, yeah, and that, yeah, all that was real.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, those projects, they were literally set up just to try and make a buck. You know, there was no artistry to them at all. It was basically about putting.
They did a good job covering it up at first, because
they
were crazy people on Wall Street. They had, you know, done Ponzi schemes. They had attracted all these other big name actors like Frank Grillo, Mel Gibson, Kate Bosworth, and De Niro and Freeman and, you know, Morgan Freeman, and you're just like, well, how did they sign on? Well, they tricked their agents, and yeah, Bruce didn't know he was there. He was getting that dementia and other stuff, and I didn't mind the first initial few movies. There were a few with Bautista, but they were made, again, these sneaky guys were known for just co-producing big budget stuff like Lone Survivor, Street Kings, and Narc, and they just kept riding on that coattails and funding a piece of crap that would star the likes of Val Kilmer, 50 Cent, and you're just like, how did they get from here to this? Yeah.
I don't know. So I've forgotten what the point was now. I forgot why we got.
You're just talking about some of these sneaky companies making. Easy
now,
cash.
This is interesting because I'm sure you read up on this as well, but you know, both Rich and Famous and Tragic Hero were produced in the same year.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it.
And originally, you know, if you watch the films sequentially, obviously Rich and Famous comes first because it's dealing with, you know, Kwok and Young as young kids through their young adult life and bringing in Chow Yun-Fat's character. And then, you know, the sequel, there's a big flashy one. But when they were released, they decided to put out Tragic Hero first to literally ride on the coattails of A Better Tomorrow, because, it puts Chow Yun-Fat more to the center of the film, and it has those big flashy action sequences as well. So, but it just doesn't make any sense, you know.
I was confused by that watching as well. I was like, okay, is there miscommunication? You know, because they're even credited differently. So, I think Tragic Hero, they're credited by their surname, even though it's very clear and evident. You know, I think I did see them in order, but it was confusing nonetheless.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, whatever works, I guess.
It would have been weird watching it in the order they were actually released, because Tragic Hero starts with a narration telling you what happened in the first film.
Absolutely. And then, you know, the first film is just very energetic, very easygoing. You know, Chow has so many other movies by the Tai Sing company that are and Golden Harvest that have been rediscovered, fortunately, on DVD. That I think he had another one called Code of Honor that I've been wanting to see for a while. Oh, and he's just really good at these noirish, you know, characters and everything. And it helps that he's often on professional productions. It says a lot for a guy who, much like many of the other groundbreaking stars, started off doing, you know, primetime TV and then, theater backstory, and even studied some martial arts briefly and then gave it up to just be a serious guy. And I, who knows how many times he's died on screen also, but I love, even on the second film, it, you're getting just what feels like references to so many other blockbusters. There's a Scarface type mansion, you know, takedown by a hit team, and then it kind of descends into kind of police story, you know, Jackie Chan, you know, super cop type territory, where people are, you know, getting in vehicles and then kicking each other in the face, taking each other's guns and shooting them down. And it's just like, I love how, you know, John Woo has more emphasis on the, you know, playing saxophone and witty dialogue and, you know, gory gunshots to the head. And they're kind of more just trying to move the plot along while giving you more content. And I do appreciate, this is why we kind of go on a tangent talking about these genre filmmakers, because they're right at home where they need to be. This is their playground, you know.
It's an interesting change as well, between the two films. In Rich and Famous,
the tones whenever consist, instead of deflecting and making you go, this barely is, you know, coherent, you know.
The things like the gunplay in the first one, I mean, the actors are very much, it feels like, it does feel like a mafia movie or a spaghetti western, because when they're shooting, they're literally thrusting the gun forward as they're shooting, you know. So it's almost like the kids, you know, kids playing sort of soldiers or something. But, you know, they get away from that in the second one. It seems to be, you know, just in that sort of space of time, there's a sort of maturity of, you know, the sort of the fight choreography, as it were, or the way they sort of use the weapons. And I think that is, you know, more of the sort of John Woo influence there, is to sort of say, yeah, we can do this, we can, but if we can make it look a lot cooler than, you know, we have done in the past.
Absolutely. You know, if anybody's not completely mature or doing it 100%, it's edited so well. And like you say, you know, every movie has a gaffe or a blooper, but that just kind of adds to the charm, just because everything else is firing on all cylinders, no pun. And it's just, yeah, I love this kind of era. And, you know, I definitely, I think, still own the DVDs somewhere, but it's just interesting how, I mean, I'm getting into so many other obscure Hong Kong franchises, and I like the Long Arm of the Law, which is kind of their answer to Serpico and, you know, type procedural thrillers. And I love how everything has a second chance now. It's not just, can we remaster it for 1080 versus 4K, or what is or isn't leaving streaming. Like, there, we got options now. We're back to kind of square one, where, you know, there is something for everybody. DVD's not going away, Blu-ray's not going away, streaming's not going away. Just have at it, guys. Enjoy, instead of trying to, you know, do kind of what you did with Y2K, where everything is bad and going away and collapsing. You know,
I mean, physical media is very important, I think. And getting a region free player, so you can just sort of pick and choose from wherever.
I'm definitely going to need to get one soon to check out those special features. But yeah, I do like what Eureka's done in the past. It seems like they've followed in Arrow and the other Blu-ray company's footsteps, that just giving you a reason to just want to see these material remastered. It's always just a downer when you get a well remastered movie and there's still just no special features. It's like, oh, come on, this is a big budget movie. Yeah. There is a history here that needs to be told.
Yeah, I mean, there are some labels out there, like in the UK, actually you got it in the States as well, called Arrow. You know, they go out of their way to sort of put some effort into their releases. You know, there's at least one other label that I'm not going to name, but they give you the bare bones of any release. You know, just as an example, Stone Cold, you know, the Brian Bosworth movie. I'm sure there's, you know, loads of stuff that MTV probably did, or, you know, some back to the, you know, behind the scenes stuff. And it's just like, nope, you got the film and that's your lot. You know, it's very annoying sometimes. And it's because the you know, people who are buying Blu-ray are you know, they are the collectors. So they're the ones who want to sort of delve into, you know, the behind the scenes.
Yeah, completists.
Yeah, exactly. It's not someone who's just going to buy it on a whim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's talk about you know, the films themselves a little bit. I mean, the one of the things that sticks out in the first one is a bit early on where Andy Lau's character has been tortured because he sort of came to the aid of his brother, and he stood on a block of ice which is melting. He's got a noose around his neck, and then the bad guy he throws his cigar in his mouth backwards, so you know, the lit end first sort of thing. It's like really, really horrible, and it looks real. You know, it's like, well, I can't see how they faked that if at all. You know, he really did sort of have to sort of chew on a cigar. Weird. Yeah, I hope he got paid a lot for that one.
Mm-hmm.
There's so there are some good sort of shootouts in this, which is a little bit reminiscent of A Better Tomorrow. There's a bit where they go to Thailand, I believe, and get double crossed there, and there's a big sort of shootout, and Andy Lau's character gets injured. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, at the end, we've got the big betrayal with you know, the wedding scene on the steps of the church, and big sort of shootout which leads into sort of car chase. So a lot of good sort of exciting stuff in here. I think it was pretty much structured the same as A Better Tomorrow, in that, you know, you have these action scenes sort of peppered throughout the film, but it's more about the characters and how they sort of gel together.
Yep. It's no overthinking it, and like you say, it is at a time where you're looking at this and you're like, there's no way someone didn't do some method, you know, punching or kicking. It's just, it's too pretty hard to fake, especially given the history.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's one actor who's appears in both films, Fu On Ching, who plays Luke, also known as Number Six. He, as soon as you see him, you recognize him straight away. You know, he's one of these sort of stalwarts of the sort of cinema at the time. He's in things like The Killer and God of Gamblers. And this is like one of the very few times he gets to play one of the good guys. You know, he's sort of very loyal to Jarian Fett's character. He's you know, he gets a great death scene as well in the second one, when he tries to kill Young, posing as a window cleaner. sort of very, very good scene. But yeah, it was good to see him for once being, you know, sort of a sympathetic character instead of a sort of typical, you know, bad guy.
Atypical, yeah. It's a lot of stuff to take in all at once.
In the first one, we also got Alan Tan, who he plays this sort of the cowardly, not exactly one of the brothers, but somebody, you know, that Andy Lau and Alex Tan?
I think it's them, but...
Yeah. They grew up together, and but he's the sort of the cowardly one. He's the one who sort of struggles to
connect.
He's the one who sort of struggles to collect the collection money from the butchers or something. Mm-hmm. And then ends up getting beaten up. But he's an interesting actor. he's an interesting actor as well, because he usually plays these sort of weak-willed, sort of milquetoast sort of characters. But you know, he's the third wheel in Armor of God, you know, the Jackie Chan
spy film, yeah, true. Yeah.
And then, but he, one of his other films is just getting a re-release now called The Last Blood, which is another.
I love Andy, that. Andy Lau film.
Yeah,
people joke very good. It's an unofficial hard-boiled.
That's right. Yeah,
because
it has the hospital scene. That's right. Yeah, but yeah, it was marketed as hard-boiled too in some places apparently. But yeah, he's really good in this as well. For his scenes, he gets a sort of decent sort of death scene towards the end. But yeah, so I mean, of the two, which one do you actually prefer?
I think I preferred, you know, they kind of both run together, but I do kind of prefer the second one. But the first one was a really solid, like you say, just easygoing, nothing to it. I mean, there was, but not to where you had to. It's very hard to get bored with these movies too, because like they're on it, they're ready to go, and I applaud anybody who can just make the shit stick, you know. Just
I mean, the stunts are crazy, and you know, they had no money for, you know, safety equipment or anything. Probably, you know, some of the, we have car flips, we've got people sort of jumping out of windows on the top of vans and all this sort of stuff going on, and it's all, you know, in camera stunt work. It's all very well done indeed. The standout bit for the second one for me is as I said, number six's death, when he goes along and you know, he's cleaning the windows and he's waiting for his moment, but he's been double crossed as well, and we realize straight away who's double crossed him, because only one other person knew that he was on this mission, and it's the scene after that where we get Chow Yun Fat's best bit of acting in the film. Because he confronts this guy who's betrayed him. He's like a lifelong friend, and all of a sudden, one of his guys stabs this guy in the back, and he's like shocked. He's like, "What are you doing? Aww. You know, I was going to let him in." Yeah, but then he realizes that this guy's actually got a gun in his hand. He was going to, you know, he's waiting for his moment to sort of shoot him still, even though he'd been caught betraying him. And it's just like, you know, the way.
Shameless, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's that way Chow Yun Fat's face is able to sort of process all of that information in that one scene. You know, it's like Bob Hoskins at the end of Long Good Friday, or even Vin Diesel in the first Fast and Furious movie. You know, there's a scene where, when he finds out that Brian's, you know, actually a cop, and he actually does a decent bit of acting. For once in that one scene, but it's a great bit of acting from
everyone's Chow. Out of their shell on this one. They're not I mean, even, you know, Chow, who's gonna go on to do other action crime stuff, I can't say he's doing the same performance here. You know, they're all working against the grind, surprising us.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you know, 1986, 1987, Chow Yun Fat appeared in 11 films in both years. You know, I mean, his work rate was absolutely ridiculous.
Giant
at that time. Yeah, I mean, yeah, 11 films, so 22 films in 2 years, and then he kind of slacks off a bit. He does 9 the next year, and then, you know, by then he's world famous, and he can sort of, like, you know, pick and choose his roles a bit more. But yeah, he was, and you know, I can't even say he was churning them out, because we had things like, you know, Prison on Fire, Ring, City on Fire, you know, Full Contact, yeah, all these really, really, really excellent films. Wild Search, which is the one, that's the one I'm sort of hunting down at the moment, because I've
seen it. I'm with all these guys, I pretty much just got to pick out a time of the year to just troll through eBay and just find something that I'm like, okay, that's the one. I found it.
Awesome. Yeah, but a thoroughly enjoyable pair of films. I mean, I did sort of check out a couple of trailers before this afternoon. One was for a film called City War, which also stars Chow Yun Fat and Tae Leung, where they play police partners. And the other one was another one called Flaming Brothers, which
is another, there you go.
But But you know, looking at the production values of both of those, I mean, they do sort of pale to what we got here. You know, they seem a bit more sort of rough and ready sort of films.
I'm just kidding. It's not good.
Yeah. This feels a lot more polished. You know, these ones. Mm-hmm. I'd certainly recommend them, I think.
Yeah, no, that works. I prefer these personally over Better Tomorrow. It's just Better Tomorrow, I just feels a little too derivative and slower than the job we get later, like The Killer and Hardboiled. And this,
oh, yeah, definitely.
I just would like to just see more people rediscover this, just because it's, like you've summed up, everyone's out of their typical element in a good way and challenging themselves more. And as a genre picture, it's much like some of these other more recent crime pictures, is really good at making the old feel fresh and new again, just because someone apparently, you know, was really inspired, you know, to bring this to life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that whole period, you know, sort of late 80s, early 90s, sort of Hong Kong cinema, they were just sort of putting out some serious bangers, really. And you know, looking at Taylor Wong's filmography, and you know, there's films in there which I've never, ever heard of. And as I said, I've been sort of checking out the trailers, whatever state they're in. And it's like, I really need to sort of discover more of his stuff now, you know, because it's just one of those directors that, you know, not really sort of paid any attention to, and he's been given sort of short shrift, I think, in the, you know, the wave of Hong Kong cinema hitting the West. He's kind of been forgotten about a little bit until now, with the you know, the release of these two films together.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's not just rediscovered, but also just but again, just finds that audience, because there's so much stuff getting reevaluated, and it makes you wonder who is doing the reevaluation process, you know, who's making it a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Hopefully it's people like us with money. But yeah. I mean, one of the issues with, you know, with Hong Kong cinema for a long time was their, you know, the studio's reluctance to release these films or to give license to them to be released.
We are so spoiled now. We can digitally record stuff instead of circulate a tape. We don't have to, you know, just so many other things that have finally come a long way. And I still see people kind of getting a little spoiled. I'm like, oh, you have no idea how good we have it, people.
Well, I remember going to, I mean, you know, back in the 90s, I used to have to go to these film fairs. Either in London or around about, and getting like bootleg VHS copies. Yeah,
much like anime, people would copy it digitally.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and if it didn't have subtitles, well, hard luck. You know, I remember we ended up with a copy of Rumble in the Bronx, and it was an actual proper VHS release from Fortune Star, I think it was, but it had no English subs. It's like, great, we're one of the first people to actually see the film in the UK, but without the subtitles. Not that you really need them for Rumble in the Bronx. There you go. Yeah, but yeah, there's a lot of films that, you know, things like Black Cat and Dr. Lamb. You know, the only way you were going to ever get to see them back then was if you managed to get hold of a bootleg.
That's true. And it's interesting too how when you ask people, hey, you know, how did you get into this, and it's like, oh, well, ask me now or later, you know. It's just
well, funny enough, I mean, for me, it was I think the first film I saw from that era was Jackie Chan's Police Story, and we were sort of around a friend's house, and you know, I'd convinced my friends to rent it, among other things. But it wasn't so much, wasn't just Jackie Chan's Police Story, it was the trailers for things like Police Assassins that were on there as well, which is, I think, Yes Madam, the first one of
in the Line of Duty movies.
It was first released as Police Assassins, and it was just this great stunt of Michael Wong being hung from a crane and then being let loose and just sort of smashing on the ground. And it was like, oh my God, right, okay. And that plus sort of, you know, getting into sort of Jackie's stuff, that was probably the starter for me. And then when I got to see The Killer on VHS, that was the you know, the sort of the final nail in the coffin as far as my not, I wouldn't call it an obsession, but my sort of fondness of Hong Kong cinema really sort of kicked off.
Sometimes and then when it got hard to keep track of it all.
Well, it is, but there was I was kind of lucky as well. I was working in London at the time, and I heard of this shop in Camden, which is called Eastern Heroes. They sold these. They basically ran their own label of bootleg DVDs. So I call them DVDs, VHS tapes. But they were well produced and had their own covers and everything. And it was run by a guy called Ricky Baker, who's still active. He's still
no
releasing.
His,
no relation. But he still produces his magazine, which is a very good quality. You know, it's very good quality. Quite a tome actually. And he's sort of, you know, got more active again. I don't think he produces any more video, you know, films or anything. But that really opened my eyes. Sort of going there and sort of getting hold of loads of tapes from him. But, as you say, today, it's spoiled for choice. You know, it's all there. You got channels like Hiya, you know, the streaming service in the States, doing a bang up job. Amazing, really. Stuff you can get.
Nice. And it's just eye-opening too, because you're just like, how did you come upon it? And half the time they'll be like, I don't have the foggiest.
Yes.
No. I copied a copier, you know.
Basically, yeah.
It's kind of like sampling. Why are you getting mad when your product's out there and people are going to use it anyway? That's literally the whole point. Like, so when you see a dubstep guy acting like they need residuals, just say, oh, please. You didn't even create that thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think there's going to keep being some cool stuff being rediscovered. I'm just hoping, I just want everybody just kind of not fall into snobby trends like, oh, you know, is it subtitled or dubbed? It's like, just go seek it out. Have a good time. Just don't.
Even if it was dubbed, I'd still put the subtitles on.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Oh, awesome.
Totally. Great being on here. What is the DTV Digest got coming up that you'd like to promote?
I'm editing our latest episode at the moment, which includes a film called Showdown at the Grand, which has Terrence Howard and Dolph Lundgren, funny enough. It's really, really good. Really enjoyed it, if you get a chance to see it.
Sweet. Yeah. Still need to catch up on some of his newer ones, yeah.
Yeah, no, that one's an interesting one. You got Terrence Howard playing a cinema owner, and Dolph Lundgren's this sort of washed-up 80s action star. And they keep showing like his sort of clips from his made up films. It's a bit like, you know, the trailers in the middle of Grindhouse, you know, the Tarantino Rodriguez thing. Mm-hmm. So you get sort of Dolph Lundgren appearing in films like Moses versus the Nazis and things like this. It's good.
That's
fun.
Great.
Yeah. No, it's a good little film now.
Great.
But yeah, we're still plugging away basically. Looking forward to recording at some point this week.
Okay, very nice. And I will let you know when this episode hits. We'll definitely do it during a crime themed week sometime in, I think, the winter, spring. I'll tag you appropriately in it. Thank you ever so much, though. This was just very speedy and fun to do. Other than that, man, I hope life is treating you right and everything else is going to be uneventful.
And you, matey. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Anytime, my dude. And I promise we can do some other cool stuff in the future. Just
that'd be really cool. Yeah. See you. Yeah, let me know.
Godspeed.
All right, awesome. All right. Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye.
We'll return after these messages.
The Jacked Up Review Show podcast is honored to be part of the Blind Knowledge Podcast Network. Join anytime, talk the talk, and enjoy yourselves. There's something enlightening for everyone with this crowd of cool cats. Check them out.
Hey, it's Brent Pope, the host of Breakfast with Brent Pope. You've seen me on some of your favorite TV shows saying things like, "Give it up, Jimmy. You got to sink this putt to win." On Breakfast with Brent Pope, I sit down with guests from the entertainment world and we do it all over breakfast. Or should I say Breakfast? Every week on Breakfast, you get inside Hollywood info and tips, great breakfast recs and booty debates. Most of all, you get the most delightful 30 minutes of your week. So dig in. It's Breakfast time. Listen at Breakfast.com, Apple Podcasts, or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a Jacked Up.